Ahoy.
Hello.
And welcome to Policy Voices by Friends of Europe, an independent think tank with a difference. Each week from Brussels, we bring you powerful conversations with policy voices from around the world. Policy Voices talking policy choices.
Hello and welcome back to Policy Voices, Friends of Europe's weekly podcast on European and global affairs. I'm your host, Caterina Villanova. We knew it already that this year was set to be dominated by winds of the far right across the board. The Netherlands set the scene in the end of last year with the victory of far-right populist Geert Wilders, and Portugal continued the trend when it recently elected 50, yes, 50, far-right members of parliament in the year it celebrates as many years of democracy. In Policy Voices, we covered both outcomes, and these episodes are still available for you to listen wherever you get your podcasts. As much as we feel it is important to zoom in the elections of individual countries, and we have done that, not only with the Netherlands and Portugal, but also Poland and Taiwan, we at Friends of Europe feel something much bigger is at play. As we are approaching the pivotal moment of the European elections, we want to dedicate some time exploring the rise of the far right in Europe. We want to answer how did we get here and how do we solve this. So bear with us as we put together this series, which will come to you already from next week. And now more than ever, we want to hear from you. Do you know of any activist organization that is actively working to combat the rise of far-right in Europe? Think small-scale community projects working to deconstruct the harmful narratives of the far-right movement. It can be anything, from working with migrants and refugees, to fighting against hate towards the LGBTQ+ community, misinformation. If you know of anyone that we should speak to, get in touch with us. Our address is press@friendsofeurope.org. In the meantime, and because the next episodes are not going to be the most cheerful that we have done, we want to take a step back and rerun our first episode of 2024. We want to take you to space with us, with astrophysicist Guilherme Anglada Escudé. He spoke with Ryan Vugdalic, Program Officer for the Making Space Matter initiative at Friends of Europe. Here's their conversation, and Policy Voices will be back next week with a brand new episode.
Hello, and welcome back to a new episode of Policy Voices. My name is Ryan Vugdalic. I lead the Space Policy Program here at Friends of Europe. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Guilherme Anglada Escudé. Guilherme, welcome, and thank you for making the time.
Thanks, Ryan.
Of course, my pleasure. So for people who might not know you yet, you're an astronomer. You've been in different universities in Germany, in the UK, in the US as well, and of course in Spain, where you currently are based. And this is also where you got your PhD in Barcelona in 2007. But the reason you're most well known for in the general public is for a discovery you made in 2016. I'm not going to say too much about this yet, but just an interesting fact that I saw is that the year after that, in 2017, you were named in the Times Magazine 100 Most Influential People. We were talking about this just before we started recording, but it is interesting, not so much in proving anything about the science or the relevance of your discovery, but also how palatable and accessible to people it was, and how it got people dreaming a little bit about space. But before we talk about this discovery, I wanted to ask you a very simple question. What inspired you to pursue a career in astronomy and exoplanet research? Why did you want to become an astronomer? Do you remember?
I do remember. I don't know, probably I was 12 or 14, something around that age, that I liked science fiction movies. I liked looking at the sky, wanted to see things through the telescope. And at some point, I also liked physics, because this is how you get into astrophysics or astronomy these days, just understanding how the thing works, how things work at very fundamental level, understand things at the basic principles of things. So one thing combined with the other led me to astronomy. I also read a few books that were very influential to me and made me take a decision. One is that I think was crucial at the time is one, it's called Red Mars, from a writer called Kim Stanley Robinson, which is still, you can read it. It's about how in a possible future, near future, is hard science fiction. It would be the colonization of Mars. So how the first settlement would be set up in an international context. There's a lot of geopolitics in that in the novel as well. This is something that also interested me, is not only find out things, but how society or how the global effort is actually implemented in practice. And it's not only about the science itself, it's about how people relate, how people organize themselves, how countries, organizations, how you can make things happen and how they actually happen. That's also very interesting. So yeah, I was interested in physics, but I also have a bit of a thing for politics and economics and these kind of things.
Any particular science fiction movie or TV show or something that as a kid that you really liked?
Yeah, as a kid, there was not that much things, that many things those times. I could say like Odyssey 2001, but yeah. I would be lying. I was more into Star Wars,
okay, yeah, so was I,
kind
so was
of things. And then after that, I think I've seen most of whatever it's available from before 2000. After that, there are a lot of movies these days. But yeah, I like the science fiction style, not only because of looking at the stars, but how you basically formulate a situation with how you extrapolate science and how that shapes relations with people. For example, one TV show that I like a lot is called The Expanse. It's again also is about the expansion of humanity in the solar system, with all the problems that it carries. Yes. The same inequality actually, yeah. Transported somewhere else, yeah. And basically it's geopolitics at a different scale. So I like these kind of things to put. With this new technology or this new thing, how actually the society would go around it.
But in your work, you go even further, actually, because the discovery that I was teasing a little bit about in my introduction is about a planet that's outside even of the solar system. So in 2016, you're leading a team of astronomers, and it led to the confirmed discovery of Proxima Centauri b, which is the closest potentially habitable exoplanet to Earth. So that's a lot of words to unpack here. Could you tell us what is an exoplanet, and how do you define potentially habitable?
Well, good question. I'll try to give first a short answer, and then we can develop a bit things. So an exoplanet is a planet that is orbiting a star, that it's not the sun. So when we think on the universe, it's useful to get the idea or to get a bit of the scale of things. So we have the solar system, moon, Earth system, our solar system, which is about a few hours light time. And then the next star is very far away. So the space is empty, basically, and now you have the first star. And you can think about stars like islands, right? And the stars have the thing that you see on the nighttime, and then they can have their planetary systems, but very small. So it's kind of isolated. Don't think about stars like going in an excursion, like when we go to Mars, which is a few months. To go to the next star would be tens of thousands of years. So it's a completely different scale. So we are into this thing of looking for exoplanets because we want to understand how, especially our planetary system, understand planet formation, how Earth came to be as it is today, how common is life, for example, what are the necessary conditions for life to emerge that tells us where our place in cosmos, and eventually maybe detect evidence for life beyond the solar system. And looking for these planets that might be potentially, and I'm using a lot of conditional, might be potentially habitable, is something that we are looking for. And when we say potentially habitable, basically we think these are planets that have a number of characteristics similar to our own.
So temperature, pressure, these kinds of things,
yes.
Right?
Basically what we can measure these days is how large they are in terms of mass or size. Radius. So, for example, this exoplanet is in mass is very similar to our own, and then the temperature of the planet at the surface, we can also estimate it because of using a bit of mathematics, but not too complicated. Not many assumptions are in it, and we are looking on to planets that are terrestrial, let's say the same size as our own, and are in these temperate regions in the planetary systems that you can get it from the star. If the star is very bright, these temperate regions are very far. If the star is small, like Proxima Centauri is a small star, then these regions are very close to the star. And in this particular case, we have this planet that it's orbiting very close to the star, but it's in this temperate. This is what it means, potentially habitable planet. Not more than that, so yeah. we don't speculate yet more. We know a little bit more than we knew at the time.
And why is that such a challenge? Because it's relatively easy to see stars and to find stars. I can just go outside at night and see them myself, but a planet doesn't emit light. So how do you find planets around a star?
We would like to get pictures of planets, even if it's just a dot of light, but this is not how we can do it because the planets don't emit light by themselves, at least in the optical. Yeah. And they do emit light in the infrared, but we are not detecting that yet. What we do is basically use indirect methods. So we look at the star, and then the planet usually has some effect on the star itself. If it goes in front of it, you would see that every 12 days or 11 days, the star dims a bit for a couple hours, and then after 11 days, it comes back. So that tells you that there is something that is going every time in a very precise timing in front of the star. That tells us that there is a planet. And then there's another method which measures how the star moves. This is the method that we used for this case. So what you see is you measure the star. What you measure is the spectrum of the star, the light spread over all its colors. And you see a lot of features in the stellar spectrum, absorption lines, and then you can see these things moving at very small level. So at meter per second level, we call it, which means at walking speed, we can measure velocities of a star at that level. And if there is a planet, and if it's a big planet, the star will move a lot. But if it's a small planet, the motion will be very, very small. And in this case, then motions is really walking pace. And well, the technology took some time to reach this point, but this is why nowadays we can detect systematically these Earth-like planets, or not Earth-like, but similar to our own.
But that is so incredible, right? Because, I mean, as you said, it's those stars, it's the closest, but it's so far away, and we're observing it from the Earth. And the level of detail of the machinery you need to use. I was reading for your PhD that you were, I mean, I can't understand any of it, of course. I'm not a scientist, but the level, I know at some point they mentioned a coin of €2 put on the moon that you'd be looking at from the Earth. This is the kind of angular size we're talking about, right? For the level of precision you need.
Yes, so that's a technique that we would like to use at some point that's called astrometry to measure this motion of stars. Yeah. And that would be equivalent to measure, motion of rocks or a small pebble on the moon. This is huge distance to the moon, so 400,000 kilometers. In this case, we are using another technique. It's called Doppler effect, that when the emitter comes to you, the light seems a bit more energetic. It's called blue shifted. Yeah. And when the source moves away from you, the light looks a bit red shifted. Yeah. And then we see this motion is periodic. It repeats. It tells you how long it takes the planet to go around the star. This is what we call the orbital period, what would be 1 year in that planet. For example, in Proxima V, the planet goes around the star every 11 days, so it's a very short year. And then how large is this motion tells you how large is how massive, let's say, is the planet.
So all of that was in 2016. That was a really big deal that made you, at least temporarily, quite really famous. But now, if we zoom back to 2023, are there any recent developments in the field of exoplanet research? Have we changed our understanding of the universe? Is there anything that you have in mind that's happened recently?
So from the exoplanet research, so what we have been doing, not myself only, but other people also. I have to remark that I didn't discover the planet myself.
No, of course.
It was a team.
It was a whole team effort.
It was a team effort. I was a coordinator, or the leader, if you want to say it. But it was not just me. I would say probably around 200 people were involved at different levels, technical level. So after that, and because the techniques are already in place, we have discovered quite many more of these kind of planets. So we know about 50 of these kind of objects. So for Proxima, we cannot measure its size because it doesn't go in front of the star. The orbit has to be aligned to our line of sight, and it doesn't happen in Proxima. But there are other similar planetary systems farther out where we can both measure the mass of the planets with the technique I described, and also the size, because they go in front of the star. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we know that these planets are most likely rocky in composition, probably also contain quite a large amount of water. Mm-hmm. because the way they formed, the theories and the densities we measure from these planets are consistent with rock combined with water, large amounts of it. So instead of Earth, maybe this planet is more similar to, in our solar system, a moon of Saturn that's called Titan. That it has a lot of hydrocarbons and has a lot of very thick layer of ice. It's like the crust of the planet is made of ice, and you can have like 200 kilometers deep ocean, or in that case is ice. But so these kind of planets, we know this not from Proxima itself, but it's basically looking at different instances of similar planetary systems, and we are learning this. Since then also on Proxima, there is evidence for at least two more planets. One smaller than that, size of Mars, in a closer in orbit, and maybe one a bit more similar to Neptune, let's say, in an orbit with a few years period. So it's a full planetary system. We are learning this, and yeah, we are kind of getting the picture how these planets look like. And yeah, so this comes from basically making more discoveries and putting things in context.
Also wanted to go back to something you said earlier about, you know, the habitable zone and potential life. I think there's a strong misconception in the public that we are doing this so that we can move there and that we can give up on our planet. Is that the case?
No. Forget about it. This has nothing to do with it, because there's no way. At least, so we can barely go to the moon, yeah, which is next door. It's one second, like this, and we're talking something that it's 4 years in light time. Yeah. That's a completely different scale, and we don't even know how life would be on one of these planets, if there is life at all. Would be something very different, probably very toxic and aggressive to us. Yeah. So we don't want to go there.
But it's more about understanding ourselves better. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, that's also the fundamental question of, yeah, if we are alone.
What do you think, actually?
I would say the conservative approach to this these days is that we are probably not the only life form in the universe. However, Earth, we know the solar system has been a very stable and quiet place for a very long time. Yeah. The Sun is a relatively quiet star. We have a moon, which is not very common, this very large moon, and that stabilizes the rotation of the planet and causes the planet to be dynamic, to have plate tectonics, to have a lot of volcanism. That there's a lot of motion. It's just the right kind of planet to have a dynamic environment, that it's not too violent, yeah, and it's not too quiet, so yeah, things can happen. So all these things might be very rare. So maybe there is life, but it never evolved or never left the oceans in other worlds. We suspect this might be the case, that there are life forms in other places, that life is a natural thing that can happen when you have the ingredients, mm-hmm, but how this life evolved into complex beings like ourselves or, yeah, dinosaurs, yeah, that might be a bit more tricky.
Because you say, so in the universe, can I push you a little bit and ask, in our galaxy, in the Milky Way, would there be life?
We would think so. The galaxy has about 200 billion stars, and now we know that it's almost one-to-one, that each star has one or more planets that are in these temperate regions, maybe not all stars, but 80% or 50%, doesn't matter. If 200 billion, we are talking about 100 billion, mm-hmm, of chances, and the elements that life needs are very common. Mm-hmm. So water is everywhere, it's hydrogen and oxygen. Carbon dioxide, we see it in everywhere as well, in other kinds of planets, mm-hmm, that are easier to characterize, because this is what we are, the frontier now is towards not only detecting the planets, but understanding them. And I would say these days, the frontier is in this sense, is what's happening now, is to first to start to understand and characterize atmosphere of these planets. I can tell you how we do that.
I also wanted to ask you, because I've met a few scientists who work on different aspects of astronomy, and I'm always curious, would you like to go to space if you could? Is that something you would dream about?
I used to.
You used to? Not anymore?
No, but you know, I don't know if it's because of the age, but I would like to be a pleasant experience. I would be ready to go to space, yes, to the orbit and spend maybe a few weeks or something like this. not very long time and go to live in another planet, that would be Mars, for example, that people are discussing, I may want to go, but not be the first one pioneer when the thing is more or less established, safe, and yeah, I can go there and cooperate. And if I don't go alone, I would be happy, for example, to go with a lot of a team of people or with a group or being the pioneers, but not by myself, let's say. I would think that it would be important to have a good company.
Social connections as well. Maybe as a last point, so I've printed a few pictures of the Euclid mission that came out just a couple days ago. I'm sorry, the resolution is terrible, even though those supposed to be really high resolution. So I know it's not your field, it's not your expertise, so I wouldn't ask you about the specifics of the mission, but maybe circling back to my first question, and you know, you watching Star Wars and other movies and dreaming about the stars, what does that make you think about when you see this?
Yeah, I see different things that I used to see, because it's like the eye of the expert, right? So we see galaxies, spirals, beautiful pictures taken in different colors, and the composition is good. I also know that even these nebulas that are shown here, when if you were there, you would not see anything. Yeah. This nebula is very tenuous.
I mean, this one is not visible light, right?
No, it's visible light, but it's very enhanced and very long exposures. But I see other things in these pictures, apart from the stars, that is kind of the most obvious thing. And this is, for example, what the CLEAT mission is about. It's not looking at these stars. This is noise for them, the team. It's a cosmology mission. But if you look carefully, apart from the stars, you will see that there are these small blobs that look like fuzzy things. These are the galaxies. There are some of them that you can see clearly that it's a galaxy spiral. But actually, all these very small galaxies is what the Euclid mission is about. And it's fascinating when you stare long enough. If the more you stare on a field, and this has been done with Hubble and other instruments, the more of these galaxies you see towards the beginning of time, right? The farthest we can see something called the cosmic background radiation. And we don't know what happened between that time where the universe was hot and was cooling down and when the first galaxies formed. And Euclid is looking at those times. So it's exposing, it's looking at this very deep back in time with the James Webb Space Telescope as well. And yeah, actually the science, the most interesting thing I see here, yeah, there are these nebula, but I look at these background objects that are these tiny fuzzy things and say, oh, this is a galaxy. Look, there's a spiral here. There's a binary galaxy. There are something called gravitational lenses. If you pay enough attention, you will see like double images of some galaxies because there's another galaxy in front making a lens. This is where the science and actually I see another level, another layer of beauty in the pictures.
That's fantastic. And if for people listening to us, you can find those pictures on the ESA website or even on Instagram. They all publish them on Instagram. And they are really, they're so beautiful. Really, I would encourage everybody to take a look and I think get a better sense of why, you know, you can get so excited about space and the beauty of all these objects and shiny stars and planets and galaxies. Guillaume, thank you so much for joining us. It's really inspiring. I really love talking to scientists. And maybe one last note to end on is that, you know, maybe you don't need to be a scientist to get excited. You said at first it was just science fiction or dreaming about space. And I would really encourage people to look at those pictures and to imagine what could be out there. What do you think? Any final thoughts?
Yeah, I think that looking into cosmos also makes you realize that the universe is going to continue whether we like it or not, or whether we take care of ourselves or not.
Or whether we are here or not, even.
Yes, so it's important that we actually take care of our planet so we can keep looking at the universe. We be aware that the universe is a very big place and we are very lucky to be in this place and we have to take care of it. I think it's important. It's the same vision that some astronauts, when they go to space, look back to Earth, everything looks peaceful and beautiful. They don't see borders, right? So we cannot go, all of us, to space, but we can look at it and be a bit more humble and in connection with the universe. And probably we are not alone, and maybe somebody else is looking at us and asking the same questions.
You just heard Ryan Vugdalic, Program Officer for the Space Matter Initiative at Friends of Europe, speaking to the astrophysicist Guillaume Anglade-Escudé. If you are curious about the pictures Guillaume was describing, you can find a link in today's episode's notes. As always, we would love to hear what you thought of today's episode. You can find Friends of Europe on all social media channels and leave us a comment. I'm Caterina Villanova, and I will be with you again next week. Until then, have a great weekend.